I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Riverside living has its appeals, but is the scenic beauty worth the risks? Many rely on constructed barriers to protect homes, businesses, and lands when rivers turn angry. Today, how levees can actually make flooding worse. While they may keep one city dry, they can also increase the chances of damage upstream. We'll find out how this happens and how levees can be used with less damaging effects. Then, Mexican immigrants showed up in noticeable numbers to Kansas City's West Side community in the early 1900s. The lack of social services led to the founding of the Guadalupe Center, and today we celebrate its 100 years of service. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. You think of levees, and maybe you think of a barrier between, say, a downtown and a major river. Levees, the theory goes, form a barrier to prevent flooding. But here's something you may not know. Scientists now consider it a given that levees actually make flooding worse. Levees constrict rivers and cause them to flow faster and rise higher in other places. They actually push flooding onto other cities that can't afford to build expensive levees. The issue was readily apparent in recent weeks when flooding hit communities along the Missouri and Mississippi rivers. With climate change looming as a threat, the issue only promises to worsen. Turns out the country has 100,000 miles of levees across the country, and some think the system for regulating them is broken. With us now to talk about it are Lisa Song. She reports on the environment, energy, and climate change for ProPublica, which actually built a miniature river and levee system to pinpoint the problems with levees. She joins us from NPR Studios in New York. Lisa, nice to have you. Good morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Nicholas Pinter is also here. He's the Associate Director of the Center for Watershed Sciences. That's at the University of California, Davis. Nicholas, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Lisa, our listeners can check out this very cool, and I mean very cool, miniature river and levee system that you guys built at projects.propublica.org. I mean, this was neat. Why did you guys want to do it?
Well, we wanted to make sure our readers could understand on a very visceral level how it is that building levees can actually make flooding worse in other areas. And so we worked with scientists at the University of Minnesota, and they built this giant model. It was something like 10 feet by 12 feet and filled it with, we carved an artificial river in it, filled it with water. We put miniature homes
actual
on
river
the flood
water,
plain.
Right?
Yes, this was actually river water piped in from the Mississippi River, because the lab where we built this is a building on top of the river. So we filled it with river water, and then we had built several different scenarios in the model. So at one point, we showed what flooding would look like without levees, and then with just a levee on one side of the river, or with levees on both sides of the river. And so we had all these different scenarios to show very visibly and clearly what would happen in a flood.
Yeah, readers can sort of click on the flow rate of the water to gauge different scenarios here. It's really neat. You even had little trees and houses built onto the thing. What was the big takeaway here, Lisa?
Well, what you can see is that if you have a community on one side of the river that has a levee, but on the opposite side of the river there is no levee, then when the levee is there, it actually makes the flooding on the side without a levee worse, because you're restricting where the river can go, and so it has no place to go but up. And the same thing happens if you have levees on both sides of the river, then the water is rising higher, and it actually backs up kind of like a traffic jam. And so the communities upstream of that, where they don't have levees, or maybe they have lower levees, their flooding is aggravated by that.
You know, Nicholas, this idea isn't new to you, but the notion that levees make flooding worse is going to surprise people. Help me with that.
Well, a levee is usually, most of the time, a good thing if you're behind it. Not always, not when the levee breaks. But for the people, as Lisa was saying, on the other side of the river or upriver, It can actually drive flood levels higher. Our research shows in some locations in the worst spots in the Midwest up to 8 feet higher than they would otherwise be.
8 feet, that's pretty significant, right?
It's the difference between a levee failing and not in some cases.
Someone, and maybe even Lisa just mentioned this, compared this idea of the problems that levees create to a traffic jam. The water just starts backing up. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. So when in that case, you're talking about what we call the backwater effects of a levee. So she was talking about levees on both sides of the river pinching the water tighter, making it higher, and that creates this backwater effect 10, sometimes hundreds of miles upstream.
So, Nicholas, if levees really make things worse, why are we still building them at the rate we are?
Because, again, a town, a farm, an individual homeowner behind the levee typically believes that that's a good thing. It's an alternative to changing where they are, what they're doing on that floodplain land.
Do we know how many new miles of levee are being built each year?
We don't. So we don't even know that 100,000-mile number that you mentioned is
right, is
a wild guess.
Oh.
We and others went out actually after Katrina to try to figure out how many levees there were across the country, and it's scattered, largely unknown, and new levees being built, you know, levees come in all different flavors. We just don't know where they are, where they're being built.
Lisa Song with ProPublica, doesn't somebody keep track of this?
Sort of. So the federal government has the Army Corps of Engineers, and they do some regulation of levees, but they're only in charge of a small percentage of all the levees that are in this country. And then you have other levees that are actually managed by state agencies or very often local levee boards. And so the data on these levees and information about exactly where they are, how tall they are, when they were built, how they were built, is almost impossible to get in any kind of comprehensive form. And many scientists and researchers have tried, and it's just something that's really difficult to do.
Lisa, is that a problem?
It definitely can be, because, you know, levees become very political situations. If the community behind a levee has political clout, they can often lobby for more funding or perhaps to get help to make their levees taller. We've reported on situations where there are communities that have raised their levees taller than they're supposed to be by law, but in the end, regulators have a hard time forcing them to lower them back down to the height they're supposed to be.
I was going to say, Nicholas, if it's a given here that levees can cause problems and there's no one really, you know, no one central place keeping track of all these different levees, are cities aware that building these things can cause problems then?
So, Steve, we should clarify that levees are a necessary and useful part of the nation's flood management portfolio. You know, there's occasions, there's locations where they are an appropriate and necessary solution. But they bring a range of adverse consequences, and no, people building them or enlarging levees are not aware of some of the bad things, including this magnification of flooding that you've been talking about.
Nicholas, if a city wants to build a levee, can it just go ahead and do it, or does it need permission from somebody?
Yeah, it needs permission from the Corps of Engineers, and that's a different situation than a lot of the smaller, mostly agricultural levees that Lisa was talking about.
So do cities wind up suing each other over these things, given the problems they can cause?
There's many lawsuits out there right now related to this kind of effect, levee impacts.
Okay, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking about the pros and cons of levees, and given the recent spate of flooding we've had in our neck of the woods, if you want to join our conversation with a good question, 816-235-2888, our phone number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. If one city, Lisa, builds a levee, then does every other city upriver have to build one of identical height to be safe, or do they have to build a higher one, or is there a levee arms race going on out there?
Sometimes there is, and sometimes, though, you also end up with cities who don't want to build a levee, either because they don't have the money to do it, or there are also communities that say they want to enjoy the view that they have of the river, and they don't want to put a levee up in front of it, which blocks their view. So I've visited some small communities in the Midwest where they have for decades refused to build a levee, and they know that they can get occasionally flooded, but it still makes them angry when they feel that communities across the river who have built their levees up higher over time, that they are making their flooding worse.
Hmm. Nicholas, you know, this all strikes me as a little tricky because for years now, cities have been building along their riverfronts as a way to take advantage of these, you know, incredible natural amenities. It's been seen as an economic development push, and the thinking has been that too many cities, and I'm thinking about our own city of Kansas City, have ignored their riverfronts for far too long. But to do that requires protection from floods, and that means the building of levees. All this then adds up to a big problem. Am I seeing that right?
Well, so it's a trade-off. So as Lisa mentioned, you build a levee, you give things up. You give up your connection to the river. And many cities have chosen to done that, others not. Levees remain the sort of default solution for most communities across the U.S., but not always. So, for example, Soldiers Grove, Wisconsin, was offered a $3.5 million levee to protect its commercial district. And the local residents said, hang on now, this is triple. The cost of the levee is triple the value of all the structures protected. And they said this, just as taxpayers, doesn't make sense. And they opted to relocate some of the community, the commercial core, off the floodplain instead.
Hmm. Well, as nice and pretty as it can be to live along a creek or a river, I'm wondering, is it time to get past that and get more practical, Lisa, about where we locate houses and outbuildings and grain silos and all those kinds of things?
There are some communities taking action to relocate and to buy out the homes near the river to prevent repeated flooding. The problem with these kinds of buyouts is that there is very limited funding to do this on a large scale. One of the success stories you hear about buyouts was the town of Valmire, Illinois, I believe. And there were, I think they only relocated something like 300 homes or families because it was a pretty small town. And relocating those 300 took a ton of money and a lot of bureaucracy and time, and it's still considered a huge success story. So you can imagine how difficult it would be to do this at large scales.
I was going to say, to replicate that would be just enormously expensive, right?
Right. And I've done some reporting after Hurricane Harvey in Houston, where the problem there wasn't levees, but it was related problems in terms of flooding and people living in flood-prone areas. The city of Houston and this county have worked very hard to get a ton of federal funding for buyouts to locate people to less risky areas. And even then, it only gets a fraction of the money it needs to actually do it at a rate that would be highly successful.
Hmm. Let's go to some phone calls at 816-235-2888, or again, you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Dale from Kansas City, Kansas, you're on the air, Dale.
Thank you. I was just going to comment. I grew up in a little town called Louisiana, Missouri, in northeast Missouri, which says much of the town lies down in the Mississippi floodplain. And we had very little problems in the town until they decided to protect the cornfields over across on the Illinois side. And then we started having water coming in, literally over the sills of our windows in the homes. I understand the logic behind protecting a town, but I do not understand the logic of protecting farmland from flooding, especially when the floods actually end up enriching the soil.
Hmm. Nicholas,
that was my comment.
Yeah, Nicholas Pinner from the University of California, Davis. Respond to that, if you would.
Yeah, well, I've actually been through Louisiana, Missouri, and that area is impacted by the same levee over on the Illinois side that Lisa mentioned that has been built. It's a very large levee system. It's protecting 99% agricultural infrastructure, agriculture. And the residents there are very upset about this, rightly so. So what we have suggested is before you build a great big levee or add to it, you should test it out first. That there should be a three-part levee sniff test, we call it. Sniff it before you build it. And that it's only an appropriate solution to build a levee if it protects infrastructure that is concentrated, high value, and pre-existing. And I would agree with the caller that does not include farmland.
You know, there are different kinds of levees. Nicholas, tell us about that, because there are these setback levees that seem to be growing in popularity where they're not built right along the channel of a river.
So that is the way that other areas of the world are moving. So Europe has embraced a philosophy of room for the river, where they're actually taking the levees that originally hugged the banks of the channel and setting them back. And that has all sorts of benefits, you know, aesthetic, ecological benefits, and hydrologic, that it helps lower flood levels.
Why aren't more cities in this country going that way?
Well, probably the main reason is that it's expensive, that building the levee in the first place was expensive, and then setting it back would be just as expensive or more so. So there's hesitation to do that. But the truth is, we are very set in our ways, that once there's a levee on the ground, we don't like to retreat in the U.S. We don't like to give up even an inch of floodplain land back to the river.
Lisa, are these things expensive to build?
Yeah, to build a levee from scratch is very expensive, you know, easily millions, many millions of dollars. And to talk a little bit more about those setback levees, we have seen some exceptions, you know, examples where a community is flooded, and after the flood, the community will go to regulators and say, since our levee is destroyed anyway, we want to move it back and have you rebuild it for us further back from the floodplain, so that the next time there's a flood, we as a community are actually better protected because you've given the river room to flow. This is the exception rather than the rule, but there have been some encouraging examples where this has happened.
I was going to say, in the cases of trying to protect a city, that can be problematic, right? Because there may not be room to build a setback levee.
Right. This, I'm only aware of these setback levees happening in more rural communities where there is actually space.
Hmm. Why can some cities, Nicholas, afford to build these things and other cities simply can't? Is it simply just a matter of cost?
Setback levees?
Or any kind of levee, yeah.
Yeah. Well, again, levees are expensive. It's often about political clout. Sometimes federal earmarks are involved. There was a proposal for the Upper Mississippi to spend $6 billion of taxpayer money. And they calculated they had a cost-benefit ratio on that project of 5 cents on the dollar. So 5 cents benefit per dollar of taxpayer investment. And that was all about political clout.
Hmm. Well, as we begin to sort of come to the end of this segment, what about the regulation of these things? Why do some people think that the system of regulating levees, Lisa, is broken here?
Well, you have a situation where the Army Corps of Engineers, which is the main federal regulator of levees, they're a very bureaucratic, large organization, and they've been building levees for hundreds of years. That's a big part of their construction portfolio. And so it can be very hard to change the direction of a giant agency like that. A lot of their existence is to build infrastructure of many kinds. And particularly along the Mississippi River, they've built so many levees and locks and dams and other kinds of concrete things that the entire river is being controlled or attempted to be controlled. And so I think it would take a huge amount of work to drastically change the direction of an agency like that.
In a perfect world, Lisa, in your view, what should that regulation look like?
I'm not sure I can offer a solution to something this complicated. I would just say that, you know, if there are clear situations where communities have built up their levees beyond what they're allowed to, that at least enforcing the existing rules would be a place to start.
Why can a community, Nicholas, build up a levee beyond what's been approved? I mean, wouldn't the Corps stop that from happening?
The Corps sometimes tries, but it's turned out that political connection seems to trump, if you will, the regulations. And to the surprise of lots of people, scientists, journalists, and others, they've been unable to stop this practice.
Hmm. With climate change, Nicholas, what does the future portend here when it comes to increased levels of flooding and the future arguments over the levee system to begin with?
So the vector is absolutely clear. The flooding is getting worse on many Midwestern rivers. Climate change is in there. The levees themselves are in there, and the management of the river channel and the floodplain, all driving things worse. So all of this means that we're going to be dealing with this issue more and more year after year.
Hmm. Lisa, as you've studied all this, is there a certain frustration that you've come across here as you watch cities build these levees and thereby endangering other cities?
Yeah, it can be frustrating. And I think that one of the difficulties is I've had researchers tell me that the, quote, memory of floods is about 6 months, that within the first 6 months of a flood is when there is the most possibility or political appetite for changes, for thinking about how can we improve the system so this doesn't happen again. But also the first 6 months after a flood is when people are understandably most concerned about rebuilding their homes, rebuilding their communities, fixing the damage. And so by the time you're done with the immediate cleanup of a disaster, it can be hard to remember the urgency of trying to do additional reform to the system.
That's like trying to fix politics, right? People care about it after an election, but then a few months pass and who cares anymore, you know? Nicholas, do you find a certain sense of frustration as you look at the system and the way it operates?
So there's a lot of frustration out there about flood policy, many different aspects of it. It's a big broken system. So National Flood Insurance Program, which is how we manage our floodplains basically, has been a $36 billion money loser over the history of the program. Levees are part of that mix. We create this false sense of security behind them. There are solutions out there. It's just that it's been hard to reconcile those with what local constituents want on the ground often.
Hmm. Okay, we'll leave our conversation there. I want to just direct our listeners, if you want to check out the ProPublica project on levees, it's just terrific journalism. Just go to projects.propublica.org and scroll around and you'll find it. I want to thank Lisa Song again, reports on the environment, energy, and climate change for ProPublica. She joined us from NPR Studios in New York this morning. Lisa, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Nicholas Pinter is an associate director of the Center for Watershed Sciences at the University of California, Davis. Nicholas, thanks so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll commemorate the 100th anniversary of the Guadalupe Centers here in Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you didn't hear yesterday's conversation with Carrie Brown, you can listen to her stories as a 911 dispatcher along with other previous interviews. Just go to kcur.org/uptodate. Friday on the show, how we've become an age-segregated society and why it's so important that generations connect. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, when Mexican immigrants arrived in Kansas City in the early 1900s, they faced all manner of challenges, including discrimination and poverty. When it came to social services, they were nowhere to be found. Help came in 1919 with the formation of the Guadalupe Center, which became one of the first social service agencies for Latinos. 100 years later, Guadalupe Centers Incorporated continues its mission of improving the quality of life for Kansas City Latinos. This centennial year will be a topic of a year-long exhibition and a discussion at a library forum on Sunday, and we're going to discuss it right now. With us, Valerie Mendoza is Director of Outreach and Inclusion for Humanities Kansas. Valerie, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Teresa Torres is an Associate Professor of Latinx and Latin American Studies and Sociology at UMKC. Dr. Torres, nice to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here, Steve.
How important has the Guadalupe Center been in the lives of Latinos in our town?
I've been part of Guadalupe Center since the 90s, and during that time has being on boards and also regular volunteer, I've seen the kind of outreach that this community, that Guadalupe Center's had. It first started in just one locale, mainly the West Side, and now it's branched out in all over the city. It's in they have a place in Belton. They have one on the East Side with Guadalupe High School.
And they, schools are involved now, as you're saying.
Yes, they now
right?
have schools. So there's a variety of services that they, social services, culture. We just had the Cinco de Mayo Festival, Fiesta, and we also have annual big fundraiser, Blanco y Negro, in September 21st this year. And it's just a general all-purpose kind of service that
right.
focuses on lots of people. They serve over 1,400 students right now.
You know, Valerie, is it going too far to say that the Guadalupe Center sort of forms a backbone of the community?
No, I don't think so. From its beginnings in 1919, it has definitely been, as you say, the backbone of the Latino community. It's been a service that has been known and trusted by the community, and you know, they, to the point where, you know, in the early days of the Latino community themselves would go to the center and say, "Hey, we need this." You know, for example, young boys in the 1920s and 1930s wanted a baseball field. And so they went and asked, you know, can you help us with this? And the center did.
Is the center, are the centers as important today as they were 100 years ago?
I would say so, but in
a different way, though.
Yes, definitely in a different way. In the early days, it started out mostly as an Americanization program to help immigrants assimilate. So, you know, I think the attitudes have changed, you know, back then in the 1920s, 1930s, you know, Mexican immigrants were new to Kansas City. And so they were sort of this unknown entity. The Guadalupe Center, you know, was there to help.
Let's go back 100 years, Dr. Torres. And when did Mexican Americans begin showing up in noticeable numbers here in Kansas City?
Well, some of the early research shows that they first started settling in Kansas City, Kansas. And then the original five barrios that we can say are really established was they worked for the railroad. And so a lot of the men were helped to build Union Station. And that's how the West Side became kind of the hub for all the Latino communities. Their other ones were all connected to the railway through that, even the Kansas City, Kansas side. There was the Rosedale. There was also Sheffield over in the northeast, which is where it was another railway station. And, of course, Argentine, Kansas. Mm-hmm. Kansas City, Kansas, which is probably one of the earliest places that they settled.
But why was the West Side so important? Why was that a common gathering place, a place for homes?
Well, it was, for one thing, when there had been floods, and so it was on a hill, and it was a lot safer. It was also close to the trains. If you go down to the West Side, you're going to see this train still go right through there. And it was a great jumping off point. And it also became a business center when a lot of the little bit wealthier Mexicans came up during the Civil War. And they established that locale for their businesses.
You know, Valerie, what brought Latinos to Kansas City? And what was it about Kansas City in particular?
Yeah, so in Mexico during, you know, around 1910, there was a revolution there. So there was a lot of upheaval.
And an exodus, it sounds like.
Yes, definitely. And that combined with just an economic downturn in Mexico. And a lot of these immigrants came from central Mexico, which had a population boom, so that the land just couldn't sustain all the people that were there. At the same time, the railroad in Mexico went from central Mexico up to the border with the United States. That was kind of the first time it connected the center of the country to the U.S.-Mexico border. So people were taking advantage of that and coming to the United States.
And the tracks ran to Kansas City?
Yeah, it was sort of this perfect storm, because at the time the Mexicans started coming was right around, you know, the war, World War I was amping up. And so there was a great need for labor. And the Santa Fe Railroad in particular would send labor recruiters to the border and bring men from Mexico who needed work. They didn't necessarily intend on coming to Kansas City, but it was, you know, serendipitous in a lot of ways. So that's how a lot of them ended up here.
And there was, what was there in the way of housing and work once they arrived, Dr. Torres?
Well, there were a number of what they call like settlement houses. So they were just like, you could get a room in this in the settlement. And then eventually over time, you know, families came up or the men married. But first it was the solos, the individual men, and then they brought their families, especially during the 10 years of the Civil War and the revolution in Mexico.
How tough was the discrimination they faced when they first arrived?
Oh, it was very tough. Newspapers would write about the quote-unquote Mexican problem, you know, and castigate, you know, the entire population as trouble. Because, as Dr. Torres stated, you know, initially it was just men that came. The intent was for these men to come, make some money, and then go home and use that money to, you know, farm or buy a business. So so businesses sprang up to serve those men, you know, like she indicated, rooming houses, restaurants, and bars. You know, Tom Pendergast infamously owned or controlled one of the most famous bars in the neighborhood where Mexicans lived. So so that kind of atmosphere earned them a reputation, earned Mexican immigrants a reputation, deservedly or not, mostly not.
So some things never change.
Yeah.
Is where we are here, yeah. Well, let's turn to the founding of the Guadalupe Center itself. Tell us about the Catholic Women's Group and the founding of the center, Valerie. What can you say about that?
Yeah, so there was a group of Catholic women that called themselves the Agnes Ward Amberg Club, and they named themselves after a social worker from Chicago who worked among immigrants. And these women, the Amberg Club, worked among all sorts of immigrant groups in Kansas City, not just Mexicans, but also Italians and Poles to start off with. And they would operate summer schools. This started in 1918 in the various communities among these various immigrant groups. But then the following year, 1919, they settled upon helping Mexican immigrants in particular. And one of the women who was a catalyst in this was Dorothy Gallagher, who later became the executive director of what is now the Guadalupe Center.
Was there a direct connection with the Catholic Church?
In the sense that the women partnered with Our Lady of Guadalupe Church, and when they eventually opened the opened a physical space for the Guadalupe Center, it was a house. The first Guadalupe Center was a house right next door to Our Lady of Guadalupe Church, and then naming it the Guadalupe Center, their organization, their the Guadalupe Center was instantly recognizable among the Mexican community.
Who administered the center, and how much input did the community have in the way that the thing was run?
At first, it was the Agnes Ward Amberg Club, and they received money, private donations, and they received money from what was then called the Community Chest, which was a precursor to what we now know as the United Way. So a lot of their funding came through that, and the women of the center ran it with Dorothy Gallagher really as the head through 1944, and then the Catholic diocese took over the functioning of the Guadalupe Center.
And I gather other services were added over the years then.
Yes. So it started out with the summer school, as I mentioned. They also early years focused on women and children. So they had a sewing class for girls, you know, mothering class for women. The classes for the children were more popular than the classes for the adults initially, mm-hmm. at least. Then in the 1930s, they, you know, did English-speaking classes, citizenship classes. One of the most interesting things I think about the Guadalupe Center is that it really thrived during the Depression. Huh. It didn't close. Obviously, services were needed, but that, you know, those were lean years. But it managed to keep going and servicing the community. It also started medical services for the community during that time as well.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking this morning about the 100th anniversary of the Guadalupe Center. And I should point out that our guests will be talking about the Guadalupe Centers at 2 in the afternoon a week from Sunday at the Central Library, 14 West 10th Street. You can RSVP at kclibrary.org. The exhibition we've been talking about opens on May 31st and runs through May of 2020. Dr. Torres, you know, any sense of immigrants from other Spanish-speaking countries came to the West Side as well?
Yes, they did, but later. We see more of a diverse population of Latinos coming in the 80s. There may have been some earlier, but it was still predominantly a Mexican-American community, and today the majority are still Mexican-Americans, but now we have Central Americans, Guatemalans, Hondurans, Salvadoreños. We also have Puerto Ricans, Cubans, and South Americans, Brazilians. I mean, we have a diversity here, Colombians, but the majority has always remained Mexican-American, which is the predominant in the Midwest.
Yeah. You know, the Chicano civil rights movement brought about a crisis between Guadalupe Centers and the Catholic Church. Tell us about that, if you would, just real quickly.
Sure. Guadalupe Centers was coming of age in the late 1960s and 1970s, and that kind of movement to be independent and making our own decisions rubbed up against the bishop who was really the one calling the shots and saying, you know, we're giving you money and we need to decide who's going to be the director. And Guadalupe Center board decided they wanted their own director and not the person that the bishop wanted. And this was this decision came about on June 19th, 1973. And the bishop was upset about this and said that the decision should be made. It was Bishop Charles Helmsing, and he said the decision should be made by the bishop along with United Way because they were the biggest funders. And the board stood up and said no. There was a lawsuit that was filed to take away the building that was the one that Dorothy Gallagher and her sister donated. And so Guadalupe Center became independent from the church, and they got 2640 Bellevue on the west side, which is on the south end of the west side, for $1 from Jackson County. Ipat Rios, who was the Jackson County legislator, was the one who helped them get that building, and they could start services right away. And then,
have the centers remained separate from the church ever since?
It has, but there's still a relationship, a positive relationship. And they kept retain the name. They didn't leave the name. And, you know, the majority of, I mean, they have their celebrations in conjunction. Cinco de Mayo, they have a mass on Cinco de Mayo. And they bring in mariachis for the mass and for their festival.
The growth of the educational system began in 1989 with Alta Vista. What was that at the time?
It was a response from Guadalupe leaders, particularly Chris Medina and Gilbert Guerrero, to try to address the dropout problem in the Kansas City public schools. It was at least a 50% or more dropout rate of Latinos, because it's always been hard to figure that out, the numbers. And so one of the things they did was they created an alternative high school, but it was under the auspices of De La Salle at first, because De La Salle had already had an alternative school. So they worked with them. The directors of both came together, and then they separated and became their own independent school in 1990. 1999, and they had their own Alta Vista charter. And then later they became an even bigger charter in 2007, so they could add the middle school and then the elementary.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank Valerie Mendoza and Teresa Torres for coming in. They'll be speaking about the Guadalupe Centers at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, a week from Sunday at the Central Library, 14 West 10th Street. More information, kclibrary.org. Thank you both for the good update. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and your weekend to-do list.
Beautiful tats all over my back. Makes me so proud, I'm gonna shout it out loud. I got another tattoo, baby.
Yeah.
Another tattoo,
another tattoo. No part of me's blank, I'm really ink obsessed. Yeah. It's like an art show the moment that I get undressed. Yeah. At every job interview, they're just so impressed. Really? 'Cause I got all my ex-wives on my chest. Uh-huh. Over here is Clay Aiken, there's a side of bacon. Uh-huh. And I'm in a Minotaur pedal fighting with Satan. Yeah. Next to Hello Kitty and a zombie ice skating. Yeah. Wait. It's Ronald Reagan.
I've got these dragons, I've got these
dolphins. Well, look who's here, Brian McTavish, to talk about some neat stuff to do on the upcoming weekend, which won't be as cool as it is outside today, I am assured.
Cooled inside. Yeah, cool stuff to do.
What's going on here?
Kansas City Tattoo Arts Convention.
Is that what we're singing about here? Yeah.
Well, that's actually Weird Al Yankovic having a little fun with a hit.
A Bruno Mars?
Yes, turning it into a tattoo testimonial. Friday through Sunday, tats will be shown off and ink will be artfully applied to those looking for a new mark or two. It happens at the Sheraton Kansas City Hotel at Crown Center. Okay, I got to ask. I ask this periodically. Do you have one of those on you anywhere?
A tat?
A tat.
I don't. I'm too old for tats.
Well, I... Yeah. No, yeah. No. You're
Devin's
too
got
old.
One. Yeah.
Well, Devin, yeah, he's got... Yeah. I don't want to say the right or wrong thing, but he might have more than one.
Yeah.
I have none. Anyway, the fifth annual event, KC Tattoo Arts Convention...
Let's go get one. Right on our noses.
No way. I'll get to that in a second, if time permits. Special guests include several super skilled tattoo artists... from the long-running cable TV series Ink Master. So they'll be there to, I think, actually do ink and talk about ink. Here's the boil down. People and lots of people show up to show off their tattoos, see other people showing off their tattoos, including on stage. People don't disrobe, but they partially disrobe in a family-friendly way, more or less, to kind of show where they put that special something on their body. So it's just regular folks with extraordinary, sometimes extraordinary tats, and they're happy to share the intricate visuals. One thing you can get done there is have a tattoo put on your body.
Okay.
Wherever you want. Or you can get a tattoo fixed, and you know what that means if you've had one fixed.
Oh. The Psychedelic Furs.
Hey!
Sound pretty good, don't they?
Well, yeah, that's an old record. But I have it on good authority, including a recent review in the Houston Press of the Psychedelic Fur Show only a few days ago in Houston, Texas. And it was a very positive review. Richard Butler, the front man, original member of the Psych Furs. His guitar-playing brother, Tim Butler, is also an original member of the band, and he's part of the plan still. If you're in your 50s or older,
right,
and you know who you are,
yes,
and if you're in your 20s, I mean, you know, this is a band to see. You should be interested in this, because the Psychedelic Furs were, are, and in my very humble-sounding, at least, opinion, they will always be cool Brit rockers. They were college radio faves back in the early 80s, you know, just their name, the Psychedelic Furs, that's a singularly dream-weaving moniker. And I would submit, before going on to the next weekend item, that the Psych Furs' oxymoronic appeal is this weird cross-section of ultra-cool pseudo-detachment, mostly from the lead singer, and yet this very intense and caring musicianship. So,
Wow, dissecting the Psychedelic Furs, analyzing, very well done.
Slicing and dicing and yet gluing it all back together for you so you don't have to, right?
Okay.
All right, Psych Furs, do it. Fun.
Oh, God, a song near and dear to my heart.
Right. Now, before we do that...
Don't. This is important to me.
I know, but I'm going
backwards.
This
is my show.
Did I mention where the Psychedelic Furs were playing and when?
No, we're done with the Psychedelic
Furs. No, we're
not.
8 o'clock Friday, the Truman.
Okay.
Now we're moving on.
Yes, we are moving on.
You were smiling.
Yes.
Okay.
You ruined my buzz here. This is my show.
No way.
And this is the daughter of Don Knotts is going to be in town.
Yes. Actress Karen Knotts, daughter of the late, great Don Knotts, will share stories about her comedy icon dad. This is really something. Now, this is something we should do. I don't know if it's before or after we get the tattoos, but it's called Tied Up in Knots.
No, Don Knotts was on the show once.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my great regrets was he got sick the day he was going to come in, so he was only on the phone.
Oh.
I never had a chance to meet him in person. I always wanted to meet
I don't want to drive you nuts, but I sat down with him twice. And I interviewed his daughter,
Karen.
Not
the greatest interview in the world, either.
That's
what I say.
No. Here's the thing. He was really
a great actor, but not a great interview.
What you picked up on, he's a super serious guy. He really wasn't a funny prankster.
Right.
He was kind of like low key. Anyway, you really should. We really should. You for sure, Mr. Mayberry.
I'm going. I'll be there.
Okay, 8 o'clock tonight, Friday and Saturday, 8 o'clock. Catch her also 2 o'clock Sunday. Go twice at Musical Theater Heritage Theater. All weekend, basically, Karen Knotts will go over her father's career. Real quick, his tombstone. Can I read Knotts' tombstone real quick? And this really cuts to it. He saw the poignancy in people's pride and pain and turned it into something hilarious and endearing.
Oh, that's really well said.
That's him.
That's neat. That's
him.
Neat.
Go check it out.
What do we have here?
Well, that is indeed Sister Hazel singing... probably their biggest, if not only, hit, All For You. And they will be part of the NASCAR action this weekend at Kansas Speedway.
Wow.
You can catch, if the cars going vroom aren't enough, and they probably are.
Should be.
If they're not, Kansas Speedway is reaching out to you. You can also catch Sister Hazel. They'll go on at 4:40, precisely, I bet. 4:40 in the afternoon on Saturday. It's a pre-race concert. Now, the races themselves commence 7:30 Friday night and 6:30 Saturday night. It's the Digital Ally 250 on Friday and the Digital Ally 400 on Saturday. And you know what the numbers stand for?
Number of miles in the race.
Yeah, that's right.
I had you.
You had me.
And finally today.
You've heard of several kinds of cat, and my opinion now is that
nice song, ruined by the fact it's about cats.
It is.
Too bad.
Only for you.
Should be about dogs.
Only for you.
Don't like cats.
It's Catter Day. Are you ready?
Catter Day. Oh,
this
God.
Saturday is...
Isn't that clever?
It's more than clever. Cats are clever.
No,
dogs are simple. Cats are complicated.
No, they're not.
Okay, so it's Catter Day.
They're a waste of time.
You know... of all the things we've chatted about, you and me need to go dressed as dogs to Catter Day. Here's what it is. It's a 9-bar pub crawl benefiting felines.
How does it benefit them?
Because
it gives money to all the cats in the world?
One cat at a time. It goes to the Casey Pet Project.
Okay, that's a good call.
Now we're talking. You're back.
You brought it home.
You're back with me now. Noon to 4 Saturday, East Crossroads Arts District. The cat swag includes cat ears and, wait for it, a pawsport. To the event.
Oh, that's Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list. Nice job, buddy. Thank you.
Meow.
If you missed yesterday's broadcast, where former college player Michael Watson didn't mince words about university deals with major sports companies, you'll want to hear that at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, connecting generations becoming separated by today's technology. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.